ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Have you ever wondered why everyone's worried about microplastics?
Or what the best time of day is to exercise?
And why are some people left-handed, Tegan?
Well, the best people are. Anyway, we've got the show for you. It's called What's That Rash?
Where we answer the health questions everyone's asking. I'm physician and journalist Dr. Norman Swan.
And I'm health reporter Tegan Taylor.
And we promise we're not here to sell you supplements.
It is surprisingly hard to find podcast hosts who aren't.
But we do want you to search for What's That Rash in the ABC Listen app.
And we might answer your question next.
Hello, and welcome to the Philosopher's Zone here on ABC Radio National. Dalia Nassar is my name, and I'm a professor of philosophy at the University of Sydney. I'll be standing in for David Rutledge this week. This week, we're celebrating International Women's Day. Some 20 years ago, I moved from the US to Germany to work on my PhD. Now, there are a lot of differences between the two cultures, but one that really stood out for me was how Germans celebrate International Women's Day. Women often get together after work, they're given flowers or chocolates by husbands or partners, and institutions make a point of highlighting women's contributions. Some companies even give women the day off. And since 2019, Berlin has made International Women's Day a public holiday. This contrasted with the US, where International Women's Day is barely known, not to mention celebrated. At the time, I didn't know the reason for this. But years later, in my research on women philosophers, I had an answer. International Women's Day was first celebrated on March 19, 1911, in Germany, Austria, Switzerland, and Denmark. And the idea for the day was proposed a year earlier by a German philosopher named Clara Zetkin. Here to talk with me about Clara Zetkin and International Women's Day is Professor Kristen Yesdal from Temple University in the US. Kristen is an old friend, and together we've worked on recovering the voices of women philosophers from the 19th century. Zetkin is one of them. Welcome, Kristen.
Thank you for having me.
Lovely for you to be here. Before we talk about Zetkin and how the idea of International Women's Day emerged, I want to ask you, Kristen, a little about your own experiences of International Women's Day. You're from Norway, which is culturally closer to Germany, so I'm curious how the day is celebrated in Norway. And I'm also interested in whether International Women's Day has gotten some traction in the US since I've left.
Well, as for Norway, where I grew up, the 8th of March is still winter, early spring maybe. And I do remember from when I was little that there were marches on or around March 8th. And definitely from the time when I was old enough to make my own plans for the day, I would join the big marches in Oslo. And the traditional setup for me and my friend was to either have a long brunch and then make our way over to the big march in Oslo, or do the march and then do some political or social events afterwards. But March 8th is not a holiday in Oslo like it is, for example, in Berlin. But when I came to the US, like you, I realized that this wasn't such a big deal here. And I remember one year, I asked my students what they used to do on March 8th, and they didn't even know that this was the International Women's Day. And yet there is a little event here in Philadelphia. I expect this year that there will be a rally at City Hall. I don't think it is a very big arrangement, but it is something, even though this is a big city on the East Coast, and we would have thought that they would have celebrated a little more. I think this is quite ironical because the first testimonies we have of some version of International Women's Day are actually from 1909 in the Garment District in New York, so just a couple of hours from Philadelphia, where I am now. And then in 1910, as you said, the International Socialist Women's Conference in Copenhagen had the idea of an annual celebration, and this was immediately adopted. And Clara Zetkin was the key player here.
That's really interesting. We'll circle back to the relevance of International Women's Day a little bit later, but let's talk a little bit about Zetkin. Who was she? When did she live? Who was she talking to? And how did she start becoming interested in women's questions?
Well, Clara Zetkin was born Clara Eisner, and she was born in a weaver's village in Saxony, Germany, in 1857. And at the time, in fact, for the next 50 years or so, women were barred from belonging to political organizations throughout most of Germany. Unmarried women were still under the guardianship of their fathers or brothers, and married women under the guardianship of their husbands. Clara's mother, her name was Josefina, was part of the women's rights movement. And she was determined right from the beginning that her daughter should get an education. So she had the family move to Leipzig, and Clara started an education at the only secondary schooling open to women at the time, the Stiber von Stiber Institute in Leipzig. And the school was run by two representatives of the bourgeois women's movement. Zetkin, though, wanted more than the bourgeois women's movement could offer. So she worked for a short period of time as a governess, and then she was ready to forge her own path. She met with a bunch of socialists, including Osip Zetkin, a Russian revolutionary. The two of them fell in love. And soon after, socialist agitation was banned under the Bismarck laws in Germany, and the two of them moved together to Paris. She took his last name, but they didn't get married. So the two of them lived as freelancers in Paris. They had two sons, and they struggled to get by. It was expensive to live in Paris. They didn't have much money. And then Osip contracted tuberculosis, and he died in 1889. He'd been sick for a long period of time. So Clara, in other words, was the breadwinner. She took care of her sick husband. He was physically sick, but he was probably also depressed. She took care of her two boys, and she worked. So she must have had quite a lot of energy and quite a lot of determination, because the same year that her husband died, the 33-year-old Zetkin was invited to give an address at the founding Congress of the Second International in Paris. And Zetkin accepted the invitation. She went there and she argued that women were oppressed in the family, in society, and that economic independence and wage work, those two things, were the key to women's liberation. And then she moves back to Germany. She moves to Stuttgart, where there is a good Marxist community. The famous Marxist Karl Kautsky is her neighbor. And very soon she becomes a celebrated public speaker and writer. Some years she gives as many as 300 speeches. That's a very, very high number. The government tries to stop her. They tried to strip her of her citizenship because she'd been together with a Russian, but she'd been smart. She'd taken Osip's last name, but she never married him. So she could continue speaking. And Friedrich Engels, another, well, Marxist buddy, Friedrich Engels, at that point declared, "Long live free love." He was so happy that the two hadn't gotten married. And then Zetkin keeps her engagement up. She marries an 18 years younger painter. His name was Friedrich Zündel. And the two of them establish a home that is a little bit of a socialist hub in Stuttgart. She keeps working for women's rights. She edits the women's biweekly magazine, Die Gleichheit, or Equality in English. And the numbers of subscriptions really prove her success. This is unbelievable what she does. And the male socialists are really happy that she is managing to recruit women for the cause. So they spur her on until she becomes too independent for them. And at that point, she is demoted from her position in the party. Now, Zetkin had been alienated from the Socialist Party, or felt alienated from the Socialist Party for a while. This is the period leading up to World War I. And along with her very good friend Rosa Luxemburg, she joins the anti-war cause. War, they argue, pits workers against workers, and the working classes will send their sons out on the front as cannon fodder, while the industrialists gain financially from the war. So the two of them break with the Socialist Party along with Karl Liebknecht. They establish the Spartakusbund that will become the Communist Party in Germany. And then Luxemburg and Liebknecht are murdered, in all likelihood by the German police. Zetkin was devastated, and she was really, really mad. But she realizes that she just has to pick herself up and keep fighting. So she now expands the fight. She fights against militarization. She fights against racism. And she fights against the rising fascism in Germany. And then she's elected to the German government, the Reichstag, as the representative of the German Communist Party. And she is a parliament member for a long time. She leaves for Moscow. She knows she isn't safe after the murder of Luxemburg and Liebknecht. And then in 1932, she gets called back to Berlin to open the parliament for the season. And she gives this flaming anti-fascist manifesto of a speech. She's very, very sick. She's almost blind at the time. And her helpers are trying to stop her, first from leaving Moscow for Berlin, and then from talking so long in the Reichstag. But Zetkin could not be stopped. She had a warning to the German people, and she wanted this warning to be heard loudly and clearly, even though, or maybe especially because, at least 230 parliament members had donned their nationalist socialist uniforms for the occasion. And then the following year, Zetkin dies. This is 1933. She dies just outside of Moscow. And as a socialist of international distinction, she is buried in the Kremlin wall. So Zetkin is a feminist, but definitely a socialist feminist, we can say.
Yes, socialist feminist. You mentioned that her feminism, if we want to call it that, began early on. Her mother really wanted her to be educated, sent her to the von Steibert Institute, which was run by bourgeois feminists. And she eventually left the bourgeois feminist movement and became a socialist feminist. Can you say a little bit about what the difference between bourgeois and socialist feminism is?
I could try. So for the socialist feminists, and Zetkin among them, the oppression of women is always linked to capitalism. If we want to liberate women, if we want to achieve gender equality, then at the end of the day, capitalism itself has to be overthrown. Everything else will be a band-aid, helpful for a while perhaps, but no permanent solution. So it's important, I think, to see what this means for Zetkin. She insists that it is only with industrialization, only when women leave the home and take up paid work, that women can be fully liberated. Yet this moment, which is a moment of glory, also means that women join the group of workers. And under capitalism, the workers were being exploited, she thought, by the upper classes. So from this point of view, the emphasis on women's rights, which characterizes the bourgeois women's movement, just won't do. Women workers can vote from here to the moon, but unless the class system is fixed, they will, as workers, still be oppressed. Now, in Zetkin's time, the socialist feminists were opposed by the bourgeois feminists who emphasized the need for suffrage. And some of them even suggested that the vote should be limited to women who had property. This was the case in Norway, for example, where I'm from. In the beginning, only women with property could vote. And Zetkin writes quite spitefully about this movement. She always suspects that these women were only thinking about themselves, that they didn't have solidarity with the less privileged women, and that they would not work for women workers. So for her, and this again distinguishes her as a socialist feminist, the male workers were ultimately a better ally than the bourgeois women. Now, over time, Zetkin changes her view on some of these issues. So she can at times be quite categorical, but still she keeps thinking about this. She keeps positioning herself with respect to the bourgeois women's movement, but she's always, always suspicious.
What's interesting about this is if she is dedicated, if Zetkin is dedicated to socialism and she saw women's rights as inseparable from workers' rights, she was nonetheless the person who proposed or brought forth the idea of International Women's Day, which has an emphasis on women and not women workers as such. So can you elaborate a little bit about the kinds of thought processes or maybe even the transformations in Zetkin's thought on the relationship between women and workers, or perhaps more simply, just on the relationship between feminism and socialism?
Yeah, let's think about that for a bit. So Zetkin had initially not really liked the emphasis on women's suffrage. But remember, the International Women's Day was first proposed at the Women's Socialist Conference in Copenhagen. So it was a socialist environment. This is where this proposal that we should celebrate this day was first brought up. And this came after women weavers had protested in New York in the preceding years. So for Zetkin at the time, it was perceived as a women workers' day. Now, Zetkin had always been a reluctant feminist, if, as you say, we can call her a feminist at all. So as a socialist, she would always insist that women had to be liberated as workers, not as women. And yet she realized right from the beginning that women workers were being subject to different kinds of challenges, different kinds of oppression than male workers. They were subject to sexual advances in the workplace. They were paid less. They were often leaving work only to return back home for a second shift of housework. So here, the emphasis for Zetkin was on women workers, but still women workers, with women being capitalized and in bold letters, as it were. And this is something Zetkin struggled with her entire life. Was it most important that you were a woman or that you were a worker? And I do not think that she would be very happy to be called a feminist, if by that we mean that she divorced women's liberation from the larger liberation of the oppressed. And still we celebrate International Women's Day precisely because of Clara Zetkin.
Yes, that's really interesting. So what's coming out of this is that she recognized that women were subjected to different kinds of challenges than men, but nonetheless, she was sure that women workers were the ones who gave the impetus, the impulse for the women's movement more generally, that work was an essential part of women's liberation and that you can't separate the one from the other. So why was work so important for her? Why did she think that women have to work in order to be liberated?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it's worth noting in this context that even a later thinker such as Simone de Beauvoir was confronted with some of the same issues. Like when she wrote The Second Sex, she was not yet affiliated with the socialist movement. And then quite surprisingly, towards the end of this book, she insists on the importance of work for women's liberation. That's Simone de Beauvoir. But with Zetkin, right from the beginning, she emphasizes the importance of wage work. Women need financial independence. Moreover, for her, the political participation requires, as it were, that you participate in society. And work for her was the best way, wage work was the best way women could participate in the social and political world. Now, Zetkin, of course, doesn't think that liberation will automatically be achieved the very moment women take on wage work. She claims that the conditions for the workers had to be improved. Work at the time wasn't safe, it wasn't paid fairly, and it afforded very little self-realization. So work, she said, needed to be humane. She did not like the conditions at the new factories, and yet she thought there was something really important about women having wage work, women participating to society in this way. Some of her bourgeois colleagues, some of the bourgeois feminists, including some of the feminists whose work Zetkin was really interested in, thought that the conditions in the factories were so abysmal that women would be better off staying at home. They argued that modern wage work in its industrialized form was oppressive for women and that it went against their nature. But Zetkin refused to accept that because modern industrialized wage work was dehumanizing for the workers, women should abandon the hope of financial independence. Instead, she insisted that the working condition needed to be improved so that women, together with men and children, there was child labor at the time, could work safely and under humane conditions. Now, I think it's also important to remember that Zetkin always thought women's liberation was part of a much wider global liberation of workers. The workers were an international, universal group, and she was hoping for a revolution that would liberate them all. So, again, unlike the bourgeois feminists, Zetkin never took women's liberation to be the ultimate goal. The ultimate goal was a liberation for all of us, regardless of gender, age, and nationality. And this, she argued, could only be achieved through a classless society. And again, work was key in order to facilitate the revolution and her dream of such a classless and happy society where women and men were being respected alike.
She had a lot of battles to fight. She had to convince the bourgeois feminists that work was an essential part of the women's liberation movement. She had to convince the socialist men that it was necessary to think about women's welfare and women's rights as well as workers' rights. So Zetkin was working across many different areas and putting arguments to different groups. What's interesting that you just said, Kristen, is that Simone de Beauvoir, some 50 years later, reiterates some of these questions and thoughts that Zetkin had. And in general, it might be interesting for our listeners to be aware of all of these earlier feminists that wrote before Beauvoir and in so many ways prefigured her ideas. We're here on ABC Radio National and ABC Listen. You're with me, Dalia Nassar, on The Philosopher's Zone, standing in for David Rutledge this week. We're discussing International Women's Day and its founder, the philosopher Clara Zetkin, with Professor Kristen Yezdal from Temple University. When I was reading Zetkin for the first time, I couldn't help but think that she was very prescient and recognized that identity is complicated. You are a woman and you are a worker and you have this specific ethnic background. You're not just one or the other. So to isolate the women's movement from the workers' movement, she repeatedly argued, was misguided. Today, we describe this kind of complex identity as intersectionality. How do you, Kristen, think Zetkin's insights relate to what we call intersectionality, to the fact that we belong to different groups?
Yes, you're right that Zetkin, as a woman, does think about identity all the time. And there is no doubt that she fights for women workers in particular. Moreover, when she takes over the position as the president of the International Red Age, which she does in 1927, she turns to issues such as racism in the U.S. And yet there is this steady commitment to the workers' movement more broadly. Zetkin struggles with this balance, as I mentioned, throughout her entire life. Are you a woman? Are you a worker? Are you a woman worker? And she doesn't have one fixed position. She modifies her point of view throughout her work. But towards the middle period in particular, she becomes much more attuned to issues such as pregnancies, nursing, women's bodies, and starts writing about that too. But then intersectionality, this difficult philosophical term, as I understand it, this is about an inability to choose between the different group identities that intersect. So if you are, for example, a woman of color, you're both a woman and you're a person of color, and neither of these two can be given priority. You're both. Zetkin, though, tends to give priority to our status as workers. But unlike the male socialists, she is always alert to the challenges of women. And we have to remember what an incredible boys' club the socialist movement was at the time. I mean, in this period, Engels wrote to Marx that if they hadn't been so cash-strapped, he'd love to take Marx, go out drinking, and spend money on women. And Marx, on his side, claims that you can judge society by how liberated women are. And then he adds, in a bit of a bro slur, that when he talks about women, he doesn't only mean the pretty women, but also the ugly ones. So this is the environment in which Zetkin writes her work and delivers her speeches. And she does a tremendous job of holding the fortress and insisting on women's needs. And then all the same, fight for global justice and fight for liberation of all peoples across the world.
It's interesting. She's trying to find this balance between, on the one hand, the sense of unity across cultures. She was an anti-militaristic, anti-war thinker who said we shouldn't have wars because of people. All workers should unite across nationalities. So there's a kind of universalism there. But there's also this focus or understanding of every individual's particularity, that they belong to different groups. And she needs to, she finds the balance, or she's working hard to figure out the balance. And there's so much resonance in her thinking with our kinds of questions today. And like we were saying, she didn't only have to convince the bourgeois feminists of the importance of work for women, and she didn't only have to convince the men socialists of the importance of women's liberation for the socialist movement. She actually also had to convince some women socialists. She wasn't only on battles with these two groups. She had inside of the socialist movement some critics. And one of those was Lily Brown. Now, Lily Brown was also an outspoken feminist, but not entirely in support of Zetkin's approach, because she argued that there are certain aspects of being a woman that are simply not shared by men and so can't be covered by the liberation of workers. And so she said, we need to focus on those aspects first and make them primary. And yes, it's important for us to be socialists and recognize work as an essential part of the liberation, but we need to place more emphasis on what really is uncommon or what is not shared by men and women. And if we don't do this, then we fail to properly liberate women as women. And this debate between Zetkin, who wanted to grant equal status to women as workers and women as women, and Brown, who wanted to place emphasis more on women as women, anticipates so many debates in contemporary culture today about identity and its relation to politics. What do you make of Brown's critique of Zetkin, and how did Zetkin respond?
Yeah, the debate between Brown and Zetkin is quite something. I mean, Brown had initially been a fan of Zetkin's, and in her memoirs, there is a passage where she describes how she was swept away by Zetkin's speeches. Zetkin, she says, was such a phenomenal and convincing speaker. She could basically awaken the dead and muster them for her cause. But Brown was always more moderate than Zetkin was. And she was a Nietzschean. She was a socialist Nietzschean, no less. And for her, there was, as you said, something like women's nature. Women should not be primarily understood in light of their socioeconomic positions as workers or middle-class women. Women were women. And as such, there should be a solidarity. There should be bonds between the socialists and the bourgeois women. So she found Zetkin far too categorical, far too polemical. And Zetkin, on her side, found Brown a pampered upper-class woman who'd never really been able to shake off her privileged upbringing. But their discussion is super, super interesting. Should the women's movement be oriented towards gender and solidarity with other women, or towards class solidarity, universal solidarity with the oppressed? Now, here is something interesting, though. While the debate between Brown and Zetkin was often bitter and untempered, Zetkin did listen and engage some of the non-socialist feminists who were around in her circle. For example, the Swede Ellen Key. They were in many ways more conservative, at least on my books, than Brown was. But it was almost as if they didn't threaten the movement, Zetkin's movement, so she could enter into a dialogue with them without conceding her standing within the socialist ranks. But the polemics with Brown, the polemics with Brown, forced Zetkin to think even harder about the intersection of class and gender. And even though she is never at her best when she attacks Brown, the dispute between them might eventually have left her with new insights and certainly forced her to articulate her position in a clearer way.
One of the things that's so interesting about looking back at these women's debates is not only how they prefigure, anticipate so much of the kinds of debates, questions that are coming up for us today, but also that so often it was in dialogue with each other or in polemics with each other, as you described the Zetkin-Brown discussion, how often they sharpened their ideas, they understood what they wanted to say better through this back and forth with other women. And that's something that I think you also, Kristen, learned when we look back at these historical women philosophers. They were interested in hearing what other women had to say, and they were interested in responding to it in a way that you don't see so much among the men philosophers, or at least the men didn't reference as much as the women did, that this is coming out of a discussion, dialogue, polemic with another woman.
Yeah, that's true. So, just one tiny point on that. It's so easy for us when we think about Zetkin and her friend Rosa Luxemburg to compare their works with the giants of socialist thought, with Marx, with Engels. And then when we really look at what they were doing, we see, as you said, that there was this red sisterhood, there was a philosophical sisterhood, and this shaped their identities as philosophers, as thinkers, and as organizers and politicians.
Absolutely. And in fact, you can read a lot more about all of these sisterhoods in Kristen's new book. It was published first in Norwegian and now it's coming out in English. What is the title, Kristen, in English?
The title will be Unruly Women, 200 Years of Philosophers, Romantics and Revolutionaries. And it's coming out with the University of Chicago Press before too long.
I have just one last question for you, Kristen. This was something we kind of broached at the beginning, and I want to circle back to it. And it's the question of whether International Women's Day has any relevance for us some 150 years after its first celebration. Does it still stick? I myself had been thinking about this a few weeks ago when I came across an op-ed in The Australian with the title, quote, "A Scarcity of Female Leaders. Don't buy the progressive myth." The author's claim was that women aren't leaders today, not because we fail to give women opportunities or support women in any way, but because of the way women are. Or as the author put it, this is another quote from the article, "Men wage conflict openly while women covertly undermine or ostracize their enemies." So, in light of that interesting remark about women, I'm curious if you think that International Women's Day has a role to play here and what that role would look like.
I would say the International Women's Day certainly has a function, still has a function. It's a day I like to observe or celebrate myself. I think it has relevance in Australia, in the US, and in Europe, plus more globally. And I think Zetkin's perspective, her reluctant feminism, is worth taking into account. These days, the likes of Weinstein and Epstein get a lot of airtime, and ditto for the horrible Pellicott trial in France. Violence against women, misogyny, is still here, and we live with it. But then Zetkin would always insistently remind us that in addition to our situation in Europe, in the US, in Australia, there is the situation of women globally. There are migrant women, underpaid, exploited women doing factory work for the international mega corporations in the global South. There are women suffering from the effects of climate change and the environmental crisis. And if we are to celebrate International Women's Day in Clara Zetkin's spirit, we need to incorporate the sense of global solidarity in our celebrations.
Kristen Yesdal, professor of philosophy at Temple University and also a frequent visitor at the University of Sydney, where she was the Distinguished Anderson Fellow in 2024. You can find out more on the Philosopher's Zone, and as always, you can listen to this and past episodes anytime you like via ABC Listen. I'm Dahlia Nassar. Bye for now.